Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, North Korea and Trump's foreign policy. And Richard, we are recording this a few days after President Trump took this historic visit to Singapore, where he met with Kim Jong-un, the North Korean dictator. This supposedly the first step towards defanging North Korea's nuclear ambitions. Why don't we start by talking about where you were on this prior to the meeting itself? Did you think it was worth the president gambling on a face-to-face meeting with Kim, or would you, had you been in the White House, have opposed this meeting?
Well, I mean, there's two questions. One, would I ask a normal president to have a meeting like this? And the other is whether or not you'd want to have Trump. And the difference between them is with most presidents, what you see is what you get. With Trump, what you see on one day is everything different from what you're going to see on the next. And so I think with Donald Trump, the high side is higher, and I think the low side is lower than it would have been if you had, say, Mike Pence as president under these circumstances. And so that would always influence my judgment. But then again, the question is, which way would it do it? And I think I probably would have said, I think I would want him to do it because I have the same view about North Korea that I had about Iran before Trump pulled out of the deal. Things were not getting better. They were getting worse inexorably and slowly. And it didn't seem as though there was anything that was going to shake this stuff up. So that if you projected the way the position would be 2 years from now, it would be worse than it is at the present time. And so I thought pulling out of the Iranian deal, which was opposed by many sort of Iran watchers, was the right move because I did not like the way in which the things had been progressing. And I thought that they would only continue to get worse at a slow rate. This one is much more unpredictable because Kim is much more isolated. He's much more erratic. He's much more megalomaniacal. He's also much more absolute in terms of his power. And you don't know what's going to go on. But Trump is the kind of guy who might make this work, might make it worse, because he's somebody who always tries to keep somebody off balance. He'll kiss you in one breath, and then he'll curse you out in the next, and then go back the other way around. And that has ability to create some degree of instability, which might be able to wrench some concession from the status quo. That's the first line. The second line is, I'm not so sure it makes that much of a difference. This hard-nosed view, which is the long-term vital interests of these nations that really matters, it's not the personalities of the two particular people involved. It's foolish to think that the North Koreans are going to give up the one ship they have, which is the nuclear weapon. It's foolish to think that Donald Trump is going to make the kinds of concessions that would surrender, say, South Korea. And so what you're going to get out of this, you can't see. And we don't know. There was a communique that was very blah. Everybody's interested in peace. Well, that's fine. And then there's no concrete steps that are going to be taken, except maybe, and we're not quite sure about this, the United States will change the way in which it does military exercises with South Korea. But the last headline I saw on this said Pompeo had now rushed off to South Korea saying, hey, you know, we really are on your side. Don't be so worried about this. And so what you do is you have this funny situation in which sometimes the South Koreans talk to the North Koreans and we're the third man out. Sometimes we talk to the North Koreans and the South Koreans are the third man out. Sometimes we talk to the South Koreans and the North Koreans are the ones that are out. So I think, in effect, the diplomacy is very, very fluid. On balance, I think it's not a disaster, but there's a long way to go before you can make a definitive judgment of whether this was a mistake or whether it was a coup, or whether it didn't amount to much either way. I'm very much multiple ways on this, and I think I've changed my mind twice since the beginning of this program.
Okay, so subsequent to the meeting, the president has said publicly that he'd be happy to eventually remove the American military presence in South Korea. And he talked about it mainly in financial terms as a drain on the U.S. And that is also, Richard, a sentiment that one often hears from a lot of your fellow libertarians. You hear it about Germany and Japan as well. We've been there all these years. It's not as if war is about to break out there anytime soon. Bring them home. What's your view on that question?
Well, I've always been much more of a hawk than most of these libertarians, because I think what they're doing is they have a very narrow view of what it is that force is about. And they seem to think that it's only to respond to immediate threats. And that, I think, is wrong in the international arena, because if you only say it's going to be used under those circumstances, you're going to increase the likelihood that somebody thinks they're going to get a strategic advantage over you and do something that's going to take it. And so I think, in effect, less so now than perhaps 50 years ago, but having American troops in Western Europe was extremely important. And you might recall that when Obama decided he was going to pull the various tanks out of Western Europe, and folks in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and Poland got very nervous, you know, all of a sudden, even he thought that maybe he had to bring them back again because of symbolic stuff. And the same thing is true with respect to what's taking place in South Korea. And do I think it's a huge imposition on the American budget to have 30,000 people over there fully armed and trained? It's a cost, but I don't regard it as a backbreaking cost. Indeed, my own view about the situation is I'd be a little bit more comfortable about pulling out if I thought the United States actually had a higher level of preparedness and readiness. But under Obama, the size of the military was cut down, the number of capital ships was cut down, development programs were pushed off. There wasn't much done to figure out how it is that you improve procurement and and promotion policies. So I would rather that we keep this stuff where we have it, not pull out, particularly, I think, if what's going on is that the South Koreans would be anxious. Now, there's something else that's going on, which I understand about Trump, but I think it's going to happen anyhow, which is whether or not other nations are going to start to step up. And I have no question that already you're seeing the same thing take place with Japan, that they're probably rearming at a level they've never done before. And it may not be in response to Trump, but anybody who's watched the shift from Obama to Trump and knows that we will have another presidential election in a couple of years and 4 years after that may say the idea that somehow or other the United States is a gilt-edged guarantor no longer works. We have to do it ourselves. Now, that's nice in some sense. It gets the burden off of you. But the quid pro quo is that you lose control over what's getting on because the guys who now arm themselves don't owe you nearly as much. And the issue is you really want decentralized military powers that could start up anywhere where you don't have any chits in the bank from other people saying, look, we're putting this shield around you. We don't want you engaging in any form of adventurism of yourself. And you're seeing this happening also in the Middle East because there's no question there is a kind of an alliance of convenience now between the Egyptians, the Saudis, and the Israelis. So long as Trump is strongly pro-Israeli, this thing will not really start to take off. But if you had another Obama-like figure coming into office, I have no question that this alliance would become even stronger than it currently is. So there are a lot of geopolitical pieces in there. And by and large, my own inclination is I think a show of force is better than a use of force. And if you don't have the show of force, it may well be that you're going to be forced to use it and use it under circumstances where you're ill-prepared for what is going on. So essentially, I do not want to encourage the full pullout. I think we can afford this, and I think the other benefits that we get are greater in terms of the way in which we lead. One last point, of course, is why you would want to upset the military by making some of these crazy demands on the trade issue is something that only, shall we say, Donald Trump and his confessor can give the answer to.
So there's an interesting development on Capitol Hill as a result of what the president said about potentially someday pulling troops out. Two Democrats in the Senate, Chris Murphy from Connecticut and Tammy Duckworth from Illinois, have introduced a piece of legislation that would prohibit the president from withdrawing troops from South Korea unless the Secretary of Defense says it's in the interest of national security and that it wouldn't undermine the security of our allies in the region. Is that within Congress's legitimate power to place restrictions that narrow military deployment decisions by the president?
I don't think anybody has the slightest illustration or idea of what it is. My inclination would be that this thing would be unconstitutional. I mean, the Secretary of Defense is an appointment of the president, and you certainly do not want to have a situation where the president has a Secretary of the Defense who disagrees with him, he sacks the fellow, then has to figure out whether he can make an interim and then whether or not the increment would have that. I think to the extent that you're trying to reallocate business inside the executive branch, that it would be inappropriate. There's also this incredibly difficult question is when you declare war, can you limit the scope of the war that you declare so that you can do this, that, or the other thing, but you can't go anywhere else? This has already been mooted endlessly in connection with the various situations on the preparedness for military aggression taking place after 2001. Can we tell the president that he could use force only for defensive purposes and only in connection with al-Qaeda and not with respect to anything else? The answer on that question is still out. I think basically what has happened is that we have a kind of an implicit constitutional revolution that has taken place, which will stand good even though it's very much in opposition to the text. The text essentially says any major war, unless it's a defensive war in the face of an immediate attack, needs to have an implicit declaration of war by Congress. This has not been done very much since World War II. Everything seems to be implicit, and I think the current norm is exactly the opposite, which is the president has a free hand to do things which are of limited scope. He can't drop an H-bomb on the Russians or the Koreans unless the Congress explicitly prohibits it. But to the extent that we don't have a congressional prohibition, but an effort to try to dictate the organization inside the executive branch, I think it's probably a loser. And in fact, I would not as a president want to have to face that, because what you always have to worry about, Troy, is the same thing with all these things. Okay, we can do it with respect to South Korea. Can we do it with respect to Germany? Can we do it with respect to NATO? And by the time you're done, you can have so many inconsistent commands coming out of Congress that it's not at all clear that you actually have an executive power who is invested in one supreme officer, the President of the United States.
The President's been coming in for a lot of criticism over the past few days for comments that he made in an interview with Bret Baier from Fox News, where Baier pointed out what's widely known, the depravity of the North Korean regime and the way that the citizens are treated, beaten, starved, imprisoned, executed, sent to labor camps, shut out from the outside world. And the president basically waved that away and said, well, he's a tough guy and that's how a regime like that runs. I'm paraphrasing, but that's the gist of
it. Yes, it is.
The way he expressed it was sort of beyond the pale for most people, but it is an extreme example of a serious question, which is how much of a priority do you place on human rights when you're dealing with a regime like North Korea's, as opposed to just focusing on the brass tacks sort of realpolitik of the thing? What's your
view? Well, I don't think any president should be indifferent to the suffering of human beings at the hands of somebody with whom he's negotiating. It may well be that he doesn't condition the way in which he bargains with Kim on his behavior in North Korea. But I think every time you have an opportunity, you say, look, international affairs has the following brutal necessity. You don't get to pick your enemies, even if you get to pick maybe some of your friends. I have to negotiate with somebody. I think he may be an execrable human being, but nonetheless, that's the case. And then the issue is, well, how far do you want to go? And it's a tough call. If, in fact, you don't say anything, he's going to treat that as an open invitation to shut down even more of what's left of liberty inside North Korea. And that's terrible. If you say too much, he may say, look, you're asking me to essentially surrender my power as the head of this country. I'm not going to deal with one way or another. So I think what it does is it requires a measured response, and whatever terms you wish to apply to Donald Trump, measured in proportionality are not the two words that first come to mind in dealing with him. And I understand why many people said he seems to have a fixation with people who are authoritarian in other countries, and it leads them to believe that maybe he would like to be more authoritarian inside the United States. Fortunately, on this score, I think that the rhetoric is worse than the action. But you never know from one end of the day to the next as to what it is that Donald Trump is going to do, which is why it is that, you know, I always say to you and to anybody else who asks, what's your view of Donald Trump? I said, it's all a la carte. Every issue is a little bit different. Every day is a little bit different. The scale goes from 1 to 10, and he has the annoying characteristic of rarely being between 3 and 7. He tends to be at one extreme or another. And so I wish he had not said that kind of thing. I don't like people being indifferent to the suffering of others, and I wish that he would be a little bit stronger on that issue. This was also true, I think, about Obama in 2009 when he tread lightly on the Iranians when there was some domestic protest on that issue. So I am somebody who believes that a moral vision is not just idealism, but I think it's part of the way in which you establish credibility with the rest of the world, including those people whom you would like to make your allies.
And the final question that I'll put to you, going forward from here, this set of circumstances, Donald Trump in the Oval Office, realistic best and worst case scenarios for the U.S.-North Korea relationship?
Well, the best situation is what we do is we get them to surrender nuclear weapons and they take a huge package of aid. All of a sudden, the lights go out, go on over all of North Korea, and some degrees of civil liberties are now restored because Kim doesn't regard himself as now being in this impossible position. And so he thinks that he could be saviors to his own people by some degree of amelioration and privatization. The worst situation is that it turns out that Kim thinks that, that Donald Trump is an erratic patsy. And if anything, he becomes more bellicose in the way in which he does it. And he starts demanding some sort of concessions from us as a condition of not taking one of his ICBMs and parking it somewhere near San Francisco. I don't think it's going to come to either of those two extremes. My own view is personalities have a lot of influence on day-to-day stuff. But essentially, if you looked at the long haul, basically the truce that took place in North Korea took place in 1953 after the death of Stalin. It's now been 65 years, and there's been no military stuff moving in one direction or another. There's been no real rapprochement on the political or the economic front. And I think it's most likely that we will continue to with this rather unsatisfactory status quo. Running foreign policy in the United States or anyone else is the question is, what do you do with an open wound that you can never heal? And the answer is you may be able to mitigate its bad consequences, but it's always going to be there. It's always going to limit you when you start to deal with other people. It's always going to be an unpleasant reality, and you just have to be prepared to face it and to recognize that this is a perpetual lien on your assets and your moral capital. It's not something that's going to come to an easy closure.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.